Welcome to Climate News Weekly. I'm here with our hosts, Darren Howe and Julio Friedman. Great to see you.
Hey, guys.
Pleasure as always.
We've had a busy week, a lot of stories on a lot of topics. We are going to do our best to cover everything while being intelligent about each item. The first story that we'd like to touch on is in the EU, where Fatih Birol has made some comments about the need for Europe to adopt a new master plan when it comes to the industrial sector to reach that region's decarbonization goals. You know, in the past, he's been very sort of optimistic and complimentary of the progress of Europe in its transition away from Russian gas. This time, he's saying that their reliance on it was a major historical mistake and a new plan is required. So I'm curious, what should we understand about the transition in the EU based on these messages?
Right. So Fatih is a numbers guy, first and foremost. And his message here basically said, Freds, don't let friends buy Russian gas. And part of the reason why he's saying that is because this is coming back. People are wondering, and particularly Germany, which uses a lot of heavy industry and uses gas in that industry, they're finding that green hydrogen is harder to buy than they thought. Building and electrifying things is harder than they thought, like building transmission, and so forth. So they are slowly sort of walking back. So in part, it was that. In part, his message was also saying, hey, Europe, you guys talk a good game, but you're getting lapped. China's beaten you. U.S. is beating you.
How, though? Like, in what respect do you mean?
So the Inflation Reduction Act and the Bipartisan Infrastructure Law in the United States have basically made it a candy store. And so people are not investing in Europe. They're investing in the U.S. In China, they are just doing industrial policy at Goliath global scale. And Europe can't compete. So Fatih specifically said, you guys say that you want to have a domestic solar panel production industry, an electrolyzer industry. Hey, those are good things, but you're losing on price and you're not investing what needs to be invested in to do that. And you're backsliding to Russian gas.
Interesting. So what we've read previously, though, is that they managed to shift their dependence on Russian gas, you know, and countries like Norway and the United States have supplied a lot of their gas needs. What's the reality? Like, what's actually happening?
To be clear, Fatih said this in his story, and this is also true. Europe has made immense progress. They've made immense progress on renewables. They've made immense progress in switching gas supplies. And they have made poor progress on other parts of the recommendations. Like, they've made poor progress on building efficiency as just one topic. But what he's worried about is two things. One, the backsliding part, that when you're desperate, that's what happens. This could arguably also be tied to the U.S. LNG pause. If the U.S. doesn't increase LNG export supply, then Germany can't buy it. So where are they going to go? Okay. Are they going to go to Iran? Are they going to go to Russia? Like, these are the questions he's asking. He's like, you need to double down on the reduction part, as well as you need to double down on the incentive stack for domestic production of these things. And part of the reason he said this message about you're getting kicked is that, you know, correctly, Europe is being financially responsible about this, but they're not building a competitive context. At the end of the day, people are going to buy cheap Chinese electrolyzers or less cheap Korean electrolyzers, and they're not going to buy European electrolyzers.
Yeah, for hydrogen production.
For hydrogen production. And often Europe is good at sort of hand-wringing and proselytizing, not so good at actually building and delivering. There are exceptions to that. Spain's done a great job. Denmark's done a great job. But, and you are correct, they have used U.S. and natural gas to backfill the Russian supplies. But 40% of Europe's gas is still coming from Russia. 20% from pipelines, 20% from LNG. What are you doing about that, guys?
Right. So we often focus on the supply side of the energy transition equation, but there is also the demand side. And there's an interesting story that we saw a couple of days ago this week about a company called AeroSeal. This is reported in Bloomberg. Darren, can you share what is AeroSeal and what are they doing to help change the equation on the demand side in terms of energy usage?
Yeah. Well, Julio actually gave a great segue to this. He mentioned the challenges with building efficiency in Europe. Well, this is a global challenge, right? In the U.S., homes lose 20 to 30% of their hot and cold air because of leaks in their house. So that's a major driver of energy demand. If you can find a way to stop that, then you can just have a much more efficient home, which is, of course, the best source of clean energy is the energy you never consume in the first place. So what this company AeroSeal does is it makes it a lot easier to go fix some of these leaks. Traditionally, what is done is it's a very manual process. An inspector or a contractor has to come and figure out where that leak is happening, manually plug it up. What this company has done, based off of technology out of one of our national labs, is they will first wrap this like home in a bubble, and then they'll pressurize the home from the inside, and then they'll release this non-toxic aerosol, which because of this pressure difference, just automatically goes and finds the leaks. And then once it hits those cracks that cause a leak, it coagulates and then seals it. So it's just a much more efficient way and low-cost way to fix some of these issues. Apparently, their claims are pretty good. They can reduce leakage by 80 to 95%, which is pretty awesome.
Wow, that is amazing. So this, I'm assuming you can't have furniture in your house or anything that, where this aerosol might get stuck between things that you actually want to use or look at and then solidifies there, or am I understanding it incorrectly?
Yeah, it sounds like most of this, if they're doing the whole house method, it's going to be on new build. So you're not going to have people living there. You're not going to have the furniture. If you use it on existing homes, you can at least deal with leaks in the ducts. So again, not the whole home with existing furniture and so on.
Yeah, Julio?
So first of all, I love the fact that we keep getting better at these things. Innovation changes the landscape of what you think is possible, and we really do need to do a whole lot more of that. And the national labs are very good at it. So when the national labs come out of their sort of priesthood mode and then get into let's try something mode, good things happen.
Julio mentioned that national labs, going and actually getting stuff in the world. AeroSeal was a great example of that. But I believe they also worked with RMI to release this pretty cool residential home energy tool. Essentially, one of the biggest bottlenecks is, for contractors trying to sell energy retrofits or energy technologies is what's your economics? And so different for every home. This is not going to be the most detailed and granular one because ultimately every home is super bespoke. That's one of the challenges of the space. But even having like a comprehensive overview, which shows how different things can interact with each other, like, hey, I'm going to buy an electric vehicle. Hey, I'm going to, make my HVAC more efficient. These are really important interactions that you want to at least have a first pass over and at least use as a communication tool to show homeowners what you might get out of it. So that's really cool to see RMI, our friends over there, working on this sort of stuff. I encourage folks to check it out.
Yeah, it's too bad Dina's not here this week.
Right. I will say that it's kind of surprising that we haven't had a tool like this earlier. A lot of people who are like, I want to understand the cost trade-offs for like putting solar on my house. I want to understand what are the climate benefits for adding insulation. There hasn't been a tool. We've been working this for a long time. So I very much applaud RMI for stepping into this space and saying, hey, here's something that we hope will help.
Yeah, there are platforms that aggregate quotes and all of that, but the space is fairly intractable if you're a homeowner. At least that's what I found. So any tools are most welcome. So shifting a little bit, we had some news this week, as reported in the Financial Times, based on new data from Global Energy Monitor that looks at the deployment of capacity of a variety of energy technologies. That coal rose 2% in 2023. Wind also rose. Julio, do you want to give us a summary of what these results were and how we should understand them?
Right. So for long-time participants in the energy transition, we have to be accustomed to keeping two things in our mind at the same time. You can build out a bunch of renewables and that's necessary, but people have energy demand increases. And those are often met by fossils. So you can have years of record investment in renewables and also have years of record fossil growth. And both those things can be true. So we are seeing that this week in very clear terms. Coal use grew around the world and coal capacity, meaning the number of plants, grew. I think just in China, it was something like 47 gigawatts of coal.
Right.
That's a lot of coal. It was dwarfed by the amount of wind. Wind was something like 130 gigawatts worldwide, which was awesome. But we still added 50 gigawatts of coal.
Yeah.
And the capacity
and that
factors.
Is China.
That is China, but it's everywhere. It's also in India. It's also in Bangladesh. It's also in Southeast Asia. It's also in Germany, which is adding coal capacity. They're not adding more plants, but they are increasing the capacity factor of coal plants. and in the U.S. We have also been not adding coal plants, but increasing coal capacities. And when the weather is cold, we turn on the coal plants. So coal use is up Q1, right? So we have to be serious about these things. And that means moving from $1.7 trillion of clean investment to $4 trillion worldwide every year for a long time. But that also means, holy cow, we have to be serious about the fact that people need energy, they get it from all sorts of places, and we got to keep our eyes on the carbon emissions.
Yeah, it's pretty unfortunate in China. The Financial Times published an interesting graphic showing that, you know, they're showing, as you said, Julio, 47.4 gigawatts of coal capacity came online in 2023, and that there's, you know, a lot of additional plants that are in the pipeline. And they're clustered in the most populous regions in the eastern provinces in China. So not great for climate, not great for air pollution for, you know, lots and lots of people.
Well, it's part of the reason why I spend so much time talking about carbon capture. Looks like we're going to need it.
Yeah. So Simon Steele, who is the UN climate chief, made a statement this year that bounced around social media feeds and headlines. The key phrase that has been quoted is that the world has 2 years to save itself. And in making that claim, he's referencing, you know, a framework for understanding climate change and its impacts. What's he talking about?
So first and foremost, what he's talking about is the UN process. So when he's talking about 2 years, he's really talking about COP29 and COP30. And he's talking about the time that nations have to update their nationally determined contributions. He's really trying to push the accelerator hard and say we need to be more ambitious about the climate commitments. That is true. And so when he frames it this way, we have 2 years to save the world, he's talking about this framework. He's not talking about some climate threshold that we're going to hit and everybody dies. Like, that's not why he's saying what he's saying. But he is trying to, you know, ring the alarm bell and explain to people why we should be urgent about greater ambition in climate. I will also say that he is also responding to news we saw this week, which is that climate is warming faster than we thought. The impacts are manifesting faster and bigger than we thought. So it's not necessarily wrong to be alarmed.
Yeah. So this is the IPCC sixth assessment impacts report.
So that's what he was referring to. But there's a new study that came out in Nature that is showing things like the March temperature record is already at 1.68 degrees above pre-industrial, that we might be pushing into a new phase of a sort of a new equilibrium in a non-stable dynamic context. And we are seeing things we've never seen before in terms of Arctic ice loss, in terms of ice melt in parts of the world, in terms of seasons starting earlier, in terms of ocean temperatures. Like, we're seeing things we really haven't seen before.
Right.
That look like something bigger than an incremental change. And that Nature paper talks about these things.
Right. Irreversible loss of ecosystems, irreversible loss of the Arctic permafrost, glacier loss, all of these things that we really cannot walk back from.
I am personally a little bothered by these sort of two-year kind of frameworks, because what happens is in year three, everybody goes, oh, I guess we're screwed. And that's not a very helpful framing either.
Right.
The climate scientists keep saying over and over again, every tenth of a degree matters. We had been trending to a 4-degree warming world. Now we're on a 2.7 trajectory. If we meet our obligations, we're on a 1.7-degree trajectory. So it's really about doing the work now of implementing these climate solutions.
There's a headline this week in Financial Times, J.P. Morgan warning of the need for a reality check on phasing out fossil fuels. The bank says that higher interest rates, inflation, and global conflict have dented the outlook for the energy transition. What is this? What does this mean exactly? Like, this is sort of confusing.
Right. So this is Jamie Dimon has been saying these sorts of things for a while, although I guess he's Goldman. But yeah, like, this is not exactly news. And it's funny because it comes at the same time as a story that Scotland is pulling back on some of their more ambitious climate targets. It sort of reflects that reality check. Come to that in a minute. But a lot of clean energy deployment, especially wind and solar, are capital intensive.
Right.
So they cost a lot of money up front, but there's no fuel cost. So over time, they are lower cost. Like, that's the way these things work. However, if interest rates go up, if capital costs go up, then that means those technologies' deployment gets slowed. And there is some of that going on for real. And in fact, we've seen renewable costs going up on that basis. This also taxes supply chains. So when he says you got to be clear-eyed about, get a reality check, we are seeing people are backfilling their energy needs with fossil fuels. That's lamentable, perhaps, but it's real. That's what's actually happening. So I would like to find a way to talk through this story that is not inherently sort of confrontational, because a lot of people are like, well, JP Morgan's just saying that because they invest in a bunch of fossil fuels. It is true they invest a bunch of fossil fuels. It is also true that their profits are up and fossil fuel use is growing. So what are you going to do about it? Like, you have to be clear-eyed about what this means. And the fact that they are saying that it's harder than people think, and that macroeconomic headwinds and energy demand growth are compounding that problem, that is true.
How do you square the fact that in most places, renewable energy is cheaper, you know, more efficient, easier to deploy, faster to deploy than fossil fuel infrastructure?
Yeah, I would answer that question with a question, with two questions. One of them, is that really true? It's not in California. They add renewables, the costs go up.
The cost, the rate payer.
We have the highest energy bills in the world. Maybe second only to Germany, which has done the same thing.
Right.
So on a levelized cost of electricity basis, what you're saying is true. But in fact, is it really? But this idea that it's cheap and therefore everybody should do it isn't playing out in markets for real. The other thing is, when you said it's faster to deploy, it's easier to deploy. In what world? We have 12,000 interconnect projects in the U.S. that are not being hooked up. It is not easier to deploy. It is not faster to deploy, which is why people are deploying natural gas plants, which are easier and faster to deploy.
Well, I think, aren't you conflating several things there? Like in terms of interconnect, a natural gas plant also needs an interconnect, right? Like that, like being in the queue, is that different for a natural gas plant than it would be for a solar project?
You are correct in that response. But that doesn't make it easier to deploy renewables. That makes it exactly as hard to deploy as renewables.
Well, I mean, then it's the easier hard part comes down to the complexity of the installation and the cost and the capital costs.
Right.
Doing so.
I understand that.
A solar plant.
But you can't get the permit for the wind farms. You can't get the permit for the big utility scale solar projects. It's easier to install on your roof, but that doesn't deliver the future. It delivers a portion of the future.
Right.
So this is what exactly JP Morgan means when they say you need a reality check. Because in reality, costs of renewables are going up, not down. And in reality, they are not being deployed at speed and scale. And this idea that it's easy and frictionless and cheap is incorrect.
Right.
So you can have two different responses to that. One of them can be, let's work harder to change that story. Let's go back to the point where renewables were getting cheaper. Let's make it easier to deploy them. That is a very good thing to do. Right? But a reality check is not saying you're wrong. A reality check is not saying your position is invalid. A reality check is not saying we shouldn't decarbonize faster. It is literally a reality check. Where are we actually? What are we actually doing? And as part of that reality check, the last story I wanted to talk about was Scotland.
Yeah.
Scotland set very ambitious targets, 75% reduction by 2030. That's the right kind of target to set. That matches Simon Steele's wish. Like, that is exactly the sort of thing you should be doing. And they just said, oops, we can't do it. That's a reality check. They are already bringing onshore huge amounts of offshore wind from the North Sea, the best place in the world to do it. And the UK deploys these things faster than almost any other country.
Yeah.
And they're not going to hit their target, in part because buildings are not insulated, in part because they're still using coal and gas for heavy industry, in part because it's taking longer and more expensive than they thought.
Yeah.
In part because energy demand is growing for things like server farms and industrial heat pumps and green hydrogen. Like, so it's harder than they thought.
Yeah. And I think it's I think it's important also when digesting this news, if you look at kind of the reasons why and all the this is an incredibly complicated transition, right? Fossil fuels permeate every single aspect of our economy and supply chains, and so the idea that we can set targets within a certain number of years, march toward them in a linear fashion, and, you know, tick off the, you know, reductions in carbon intensity year after year after year and get there when we say we will, is reality is never that simple. And, you know, we're facing that. I think there's a danger, right, with the stories and reading them and saying, oh, I guess the whole idea doesn't work, right? Which is, I think, a message that I want to make sure we don't lose here, like that is not what these stories are about.
Yeah, true. We talked about this exactly in the past about EV growth, right? People are saying, oh man, right. EVs are actually not going to work. Look at how bad the results are for EV makers. And it's like, no, like consumers have been adopting them at record paces, just not as fast as we thought it was. And that's not to say that they're right or wrong. It's that there are legitimate challenges to be solved on the charging front, the cost front, so on.
Right.
And it's also, if Scotland ends up hitting a 70% reduction instead of a 75% reduction, that's also a win, right? So even if they hit a 60% reduction,
they're over 50%. So like we shouldn't lose that. Well, it's not like they're, it's business as usual. Let's forget it.
Correct. And the UK has done more than almost any nation to achieve in real terms their decarbonization goals. They just have. Mm-hmm. And that is to be celebrated. But going from 50% reduction to 75% reduction is really hard because it means you've done all the cheap and easy stuff. And that takes longer and it's more expensive. You can't lose that either. Mm-hmm. The fact that the first 50% may have been relatively straightforward if you happen to live in the North Sea, great. like that's good and we should celebrate it. And Amy Harder had a story in Cypher this week saying, hey, let's celebrate our wins. We're doing pretty good. And that's a good thing to do, too. Mm-hmm. But as we saw today, it's harder than we thought. Mm-hmm.
We got through a lot today. Thank you, guys. It's great to see you. And we'll be tracking these stories in the weeks to come.
Until next time.
We missed you, Dina.